good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And tonight, we are blessed with a great interview, I am sure, with Audrey Levy, who is the author of a novel. I don't often get to review novels, but this was exciting because I wanted to get into this because I think, one, it's, you know, the title was very intriguing, which is Noelle's Ark, A Story of Redemption. And it, you know, I have to say that I read this book in one sitting, was very intrigued by it, and it certainly gives people hope. So welcome, Audrey.
Thank you, Lori.
Let's talk a little bit about, you know, how did you get from where you are or where you were to where you are now?
Well, once upon a time, I was a Jewish American princess,
mm-hmm.
and you know, born with the proverbial spoon in my mouth. And my family hoped and prayed that one day I would marry a rich and handsome Jewish prince, and that we'd all live happily ever after. I'm sure some of your listeners have a family that has plans for them. And instead of that happening, my parents disinherited me, and my two older brothers honored my parents' wills and slipped the approximately $600,000 that would have come to me upon my parents' death, and each walked away with $900,000.
Wow.
And so my dad died in March 26th of 1993, and I lost my house to foreclosure in April of 1993. We moved out of the house the week after my dad died. And my mom passed away December 5th, 1994. And my plan B home after the foreclosure, a little rent-controlled studio on Santa Monica Beach in California that I'd had for 19 years, that was red-tagged after the Los Angeles earthquake in 1995, so I had to give that up. And the non-Jewish prince, Dr. James Spencer, who the book is about, that I chose to love and live with for 20 years instead of marrying, and my family really despised him and blamed him for our estrangement. He died July 16, 1998, and he was only 56 from complications of alcoholism. And so after all of those losses, I started to drink myself pretty heavily, and I became what they call suicidal with a plan. I started saving pills so that I could execute that plan, and I was waiting for my dog to die before doing the deed because I didn't want to abandon her. My dog Sylvie was a beautiful black German Shepherd, and she was my only friend at that point in time. I had messed up my relationship with my family, and I perceived that my guy, my honey, had died on my watch. I blamed myself for it. And I was, you know, drinking rum in the morning and smoking marijuana all day and eating everything in sight and waiting for the day that I could take myself out. And I collected a bunch of pills. I had like a gallon-sized baggie full of pain pills and tranquilizers and doggy medicine and over-the-counter meds that I knew would mess up my liver. And I was just waiting for Sylvie to die. And it wasn't until June 22nd of 2002 that I actually hit what I, you know, would call my bottom. Sylvie had passed away, my dog had passed away in July of 2001, and I had hung on for one more year, hoping against hope that something would change. And finally, I realized that it was me that had to change. Basically, I had to get clean and sober because I was at death's door. I was thinking about suicide all the time. And 3 days after throwing away the rum and the pot, I handed over all those suicide pills to a psychiatrist, a very nice man, Dr. Harvey Sternbach. And I made a verbal contract with him that I wouldn't hurt myself. And it was either that or be locked up in a psych ward for 72 hours for being a danger to myself. So Harvey allowed me to choose my freedom rather than a jail of my own making. And, it would take me 7 more years till now, essentially, before I made a conscious decision to truly change my goals, and that's what prompted me to write the book. And I just decided that instead of trying to be rich and famous and approved of and liked by everybody, because I'm a total people pleaser, I don't know if you're a people pleaser, any of the listeners are people pleasers, but I just decided to stop being a victim and instead attempt to sort of triumph by, you know, sharing my story with other people and caring about what happens to other people and literally working with others. And I just decided to let my happiness depend on an inside job rather than an outside job. You know, the approval, which is a requirement for acceptance in the outer world, is actually an impediment to acceptance in the inner world. Life doesn't seek our approval. You know, it just sort of insists that we accept life on its terms and doesn't care whether or not we approve of it. And our challenge is to be emotionally comfortable regardless. So situations often change after we accept them, but they never change simply because we're unhappy with them.
Mm-hmm.
One of my mentors said that life is not painful, but it's our resistance to life that's painful. And I learned that there is a difference between acceptance and approval. In fact, in the psychological world, the world between our ears, the only world where happiness can be found, approval really isn't even a consideration. I was definitely a victim, and unfortunately I was victimized by those people who are supposed to love you the most, which is your family.
Mm-hmm.
My dad used to tell me that friends were ships that passed in the night, but your family was always your family, and your family were the only ones that mattered. And he would get very angry with me when I was a teenager and wanted to spend time with my friends instead of my family. And yet, ironically, it was my family that disinherited me and my friends who taught me that true wealth is measured not by dollars in the pocket, but, you know, by love in the heart.
Mm-hmm.
The first time my dad threatened to disinherit me, I was only 12 years old. And, you know, I had learned in school that day about adopting children. And I came home and at the dinner table was sharing what I had learned and said that I wanted to have three kids the way my parents had and also to adopt three kids. And my dad got really angry. He said that when you adopt the children, you adopted other people's problems, and there was no way that he was going to let anybody other than a blood relative get a dime of his hard-earned blood, sweat, and tears. And when I asked him what he meant, he said, well, you know, when you adopt a child, you're risking that child might have inherited traits from their real parents that make the kid a thief or a drug addict or just plain crazy. And I said, well, that doesn't matter. Somebody has to adopt these kids. And he said, well, it wasn't going to be me. And that, you know, if I insisted on adopting somebody else's kids, he would disinherit me. And I was 12. So, you know, the second time was when I was 18. And that was when I wanted to spend time with an old boyfriend that my dad had forbidden me to see. The boy had broken up with me after we announced we were like very young. We were both 18, and we announced that we were wanting to get engaged, and we announced it to both sets of parents, and then we broke up after that. So my father felt that was very embarrassing and humiliating, and he didn't want me to spend any time with this kid. I wanted to try and repair the relationship, and he said, absolutely not. And that if I tried without his approval, he would just disown me, and he'd no longer have a daughter, and I'd be dead in his eyes. And on my 18th birthday, he used a red leather belt to sort of try and beat me into submission. And he had that belt in his dresser drawer that he kept there all those years to use on my brothers. And I don't want to misrepresent. I mean, my brothers never ended up with any broken bones. They never ended up in a hospital. You know, he just was from a different school. He was a different age, and that was the way people did it then. And he had never used that belt on me until I was 18. But, you know, I just said, I'm not going to stick around with this. And you know, my mother and my brothers watched that altercation between my father and me, and they didn't do anything to stop what was going on. And you know, in today's world, that would be termed physical and emotional abuse. And, again, I don't want to misrepresent it. I wasn't physically injured, I was emotionally injured, but the act itself would be considered physical abuse by today's standards.
Mm-hmm.
And then after my dad died, you know, I tried to reconcile with my mom, and she just wasn't having it. She was convinced that that I had essentially killed my dad, even though he died at the age of 87. She just felt that, you know, that our estrangement had contributed to his unhappiness near the end. And at his funeral, I said to her, you know, I approached her and I said, "I love you, Mom." And she said, "Well, I used to feel the same way about you."
Oh, my goodness.
And that was really hurtful. It was very cold. And after she passed away in December of 1994, my two brothers were the executors of my parents' will. And I was at my mom's bedside when she passed, and I awakened my brothers to tell them that she stopped breathing. And, you know, that we were, on that night, we were close. The next day, as we were going through my parents' belongings, my brother said that there was too much to be gone through at that point in time, and we should just come back after the Christmas holidays to divide everything up. And, you know, like I flew back to Los Angeles, where I'd been living since 1975. And the day after Christmas, which is my birthday, December 26th, usually they would call me on my birthday, but this year they called me a few days early, or that year, rather, in 1994, they called me a few days early to say that they were going away for the holidays. They were law partners, and so they called me from their office, like on a phone extension, to say that one was going skiing and the other one was going to Palm Beach, and they weren't sure if they'd be near phones on the actual day of my birthday, so they were calling a few days early to wish me a happy birthday. And I thanked them, and I asked if there was anything I needed to do to get the estate going while they were out of town, and that's when they told me that my parents didn't want me to have anything. They said that they didn't want to tell me right after my mom died because they didn't want to hurt my feelings, but the fact of the matter was that my parents were very clear in that I was to get nothing, no possessions and no money. And so I was really dumbfounded, and I said, "But Mom and I made peace that last week, you know." I reminded them that she had told me I could have her wedding ring, and that she had told them herself that she had forgiven me. And they said that that was only to my face, that when I would walk out of the room and they would ask her if she wanted to change her will, she said no. And so I said, "Well, so, but everything is yours now, right, to split between you?" And they agreed that yes, it was. So I said, "Well, then why aren't you giving me something from each of your shares? Because you know what Dad was like. You know he could get very explosively angry, and you know, it just doesn't seem right." And, you know, they acknowledged that it belonged to them now, but they said that they still weren't going to give me anything. And I became very angry with them. At one point, you know, my middle brother just said, "Listen, you know, Dad issued edicts. You better follow my orders. This will is the order of how I want my property disposed of. And Audrey's no daughter to me, that I treated him terribly as a daughter, and I treated my mother terribly as a daughter. And that coincidentally, I might come from their blood, but that was just a coincidence. It wasn't by my actions or my deeds." And so I was really overwhelmed. And I asked my brother, "But do you think that's true?" And he said, "Yes, I do."
Oh.
"Since the 1980s to the time of their death, absolutely." And I you know, I said, "Well, but I moved out to California in 1975, and I just felt like he'd hit me in the stomach with a baseball bat. I mean, when I moved to California in the first place, it was to get away from the awful stuff that was happening between my dad and me, and I had acted to take care of myself, not against them. And yet, after that conversation with my brothers, I began to live with the idea in my head that I'd been a terrible daughter." And that's when I started to have nightmares, literally. And that was the impetus for what had me write the book, because for the next 11 years, I had debilitating nightmares. I would wake up screaming, "Help," and call 911. And I live on a houseboat, so in the summertime, I had to start closing my windows because my neighbors once heard me screaming, "Call 911 at 2 in the morning," and they checked to make sure I was all right. And after my significant other, Jimmy, passed away, the nightmares got worse.
Mm-hmm.
And between dreams of being attacked by an alcoholic with a bloody knife or having my family stomp on me, I just couldn't get any rest. And I tried everything to stop the nightmares. I had a sleep test at UCLA. I tried taking prescribed sleeping pills. I tried abusing sleeping pills. I tried praying. I tried writing out my resentments and reading them to someone and then burning the pages. I tried exercising. I dieted. I lost weight and then gained it back plus more. You know, like Oreo cookies and Haagen-Dazs became my constant companions. And I'm sure other people have turned to food for comfort, so they know what that's like. And then I tried giving up sugar and caffeine and cigarettes, and I had a bunch of psychotherapy. I actually am a psychotherapist. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist since 1979, and the irony is that I've never been married, and my family threw me out with the bathwater, so it's kind of strange that that's the degree that I ended up getting. But, you know, I think that I was a victim for a long time, and the tide started to change in 1999.
What started that?
My drinking had gotten out of control, and I started calling people late at night to cry, and I got lucky. A very old friend of mine who had spent a lot of time with Jimmy and me, I called him to let him know that Jimmy had passed and asked him why he had stopped coming around to visit us, and he told me that he had joined AA and that he couldn't hang out with his old companions that were still drinking and getting high. And so he came over the very next day and let me know that he'd been sober for 11 years and he had a brand new life and wasn't necessarily religious, but he talked about doing what was necessary to be spiritually fit one day at a time. And so there my old friend was, clean and sober. He had a totally new life and I had nothing. You know, I mean, I was saving pills and hiding my rum behind the computer and waiting for my dog to die, and I had lost everybody and everything, and as soon as my dog died, I was going to just take myself out, and I blamed myself for what happened with Jimmy, and I blamed myself for what happened with my parents and my brothers. My brothers got very angry with me when I wanted to see a copy of the wills, and so I had to, because I didn't believe them. You know, when we were kids, we would play Monopoly, and they would steal money from the bank and stuff like that. So I just figured, well, maybe this is, you know, maybe it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hired an attorney so that I could get to see the wills. And that really angered them very much so. And we pushed forward to until a deposition where, you know, everything was on the record. And when the deposition was over, the attorneys just said that my father had tied up the will in a box and my brothers had just put a big red ribbon on it for him. Because, you know, my dad was a lawyer and both my brothers were lawyers and they inherited his 50-year-old law firm. And they all hoped that I would become a lawyer too and marry a doctor or a lawyer or at least a rich businessman, Jewish, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, like my dad made it clear that if I married a lawyer, they would make him a profit-sharing partner rather than a voting partner because people get divorced. And that was the same kind of thing about when I wanted to adopt children, that unless you were, like, related by blood, that you couldn't trust anybody. And you know, I'd say, but if I get married, Dad, I'm going to, you know, trust my future husband implicitly. And he said, don't be ridiculous. You don't trust anybody except your family. And obviously, that sure didn't turn out to be true. So I didn't want to be a lawyer. I didn't want to stay in New Jersey, and I wanted to go off and try on my own. And so that's what I did. In 1975, I came out to California, and I got my therapist license. And I did ultimately see the wills. When I started legal proceedings, they had to produce them, and it said that my parents had left me $100. And apparently there's a law that says if parents forget to mention a child in a will due to dementia or whatever, then you can claim that however many siblings there were or there are, that they have to divide the estate equally. Mm-hmm. So by leaving me that small amount of money, it indicates that my parents didn't forget about me. And when I asked my brother about that, I said, you know, why didn't you at least tell me that you got that I got $100? Why did you say I got nothing? And he said, because $100 is nothing. And I said, but it's not nothing. It's $100, and I never even got that. So he sent me a check for $100 with a letter on his law firm stationery that basically said if I cashed the check, that the payment was in full and final settlement of any and all claims. And I got really upset and ripped up the check and the letter and threw them both away. And, you know, I'd gives me goosebumps. I don't want to cry now, but, you know, I'd rather laugh. But the point is that it does give me goosebumps, and it takes me back to all of it. It takes me back to when I perceived myself as being a victim and all the things that happened that I tried so hard to fix and I couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the thing is that things change. I mean, that's the most important thing for people to hold on to, is that things do change. And after a 7-year estrangement from my brothers, I called them when 9/11 happened. You know, they lived in New Jersey at the time, both of them, and they spent a lot of time in New York with their families, as I did growing up. And the newscasters kept asking if we knew where our loved ones were, and I realized that my brothers and their families were my loved ones. So I called them to make sure they were okay. And I think that by doing that, I took the first step in forgiveness and started building new relationships. And, you know, today, my brothers each send me $1,000 on my birthday, which I think is very generous. And, you know, it's kind of funny, but if I live to be 300 years old, I'll get that $600,000. But, you know, I mean, to send somebody $1,000 on their birthday is a very generous gift if you, you know, take it out of context. And I just, you know, I just realized that nobody owes anybody anything. I mean, they're... You know, it was my father's choice and my mother's choice to do with their estate as they wished to do. They didn't owe me anything. And, you know, the fact that they told me all the years I was growing up that we would split everything, well, they were entitled to change their mind. We're all entitled to change their minds. And my brothers, again, also, I mean, they don't owe it to me. The fact, you know, would it be generous to give it? Would it be nice to give it? Sure, but they don't owe it to me. And that was a huge shift to make in my brain, that nobody owes anybody anything. And once I made that shift consciously, the next step was to make it unconsciously, because I still was having all these nightmares. And like a badger, I was relentlessly persistent that there had to be, you know, like I just had faith that there had to be some kind of a way to fix my sleep. And, I was finally referred to what they call EMDR treatment. I don't know if you know about that.
No.
It stands for Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing.
Okay.
And it was created by Dr. Francine Shapiro, and it was to help heal post-traumatic stress. They used it with soldiers and victims of rape and things like that. And I did my research, and I found the best EMDR therapist in Southern California, Dr. Kurt Rounson. And he had studied with Francine Shapiro personally and had taken over a great deal of the teaching of the EMDR to clinicians. And so working with Kurt, I learned how to actually change the tapes inside my head to stop those haunting memories. And I learned how to change the channels in my brain. And perhaps most importantly, I began to write this novel based on my true life experiences. And I called it Noelle's Ark, and it's about Jimmy. It's about an alcoholic atheist, Jimmy Splendor, who dies and wakes up in heaven. And as an angel, he's able to come back and help the woman he left behind to heal her nightmares and move on with her life. And through the purging of my memories with him and with my families, and in the book, I have written conversations with the angels of Jimmy and my parents. And through all of that, I was able to finally diminish the nightmares to a trickle.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the ugly dreams and my yelling in my sleep can still bite me, but it's usually only when I'm under stress or I eat a lot of sugar. But for the most part, I get a lot more rest than in the old days. And so, you know, that pretty much explains how I got here, I think.
Yeah,
that was
definitely
a very long answer. I'm sorry.
No, that's good. It certainly answers my next question, which was going to be, you know, how much of this story is Audrey's story? And you know, at the back you have a review by Jay Leno who says, you know, this is your story. So clearly everything that you wrote was to help you, like, as you say, purge yourself of the memories and the pain and to work through the things that happen. And we've all have, you know, our story. Your story is very dramatic, and it's very painful, and it's very, I mean, in a sense, it's beautiful that you were able to get to a place of forgiveness. Let's talk a little bit about some of the themes that were in your story. And, you know, as you say, you are a therapist, so you know some of what you had to go through to, you know, to, I'm assuming this would probably help your practice in helping others to also get to a place of redemption and forgiveness.
Very much so. When I'm doing therapy with people, it's kind of like going to a gym, and you know, it's like a workout. It reminds me of what I need to do for me, and when I do therapy, I tend to use my life experiences as examples rather than necessarily giving advice or telling people what they should or shouldn't do. I don't think it's a good idea to tell people what they should or shouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
All I can do is say, well, this was my experience, and this is what I did, and this is what worked for me.
Wow. So you're that open with everybody?
Pretty much. I mean, you know, I've done a lot of reading and a lot of studying, and they talk about self-disclosure. You know, like Freud didn't disclose anything about himself
right.
at all. He barely did any talking to his patients. He just listened. But the newer schools of thought, if it's appropriate to use self-disclosure, I think it's fine.
Oh, I'm big on self-disclosure. I think giving examples and having the examples be relevant to who you are and to where you've come and where you're going, is, I think it's a tool that, you know, is necessary for anybody, because they, having someone just listen, and, you know, I know that there are a lot of great therapists out there that still follow some of the more traditional therapies. I think, you know, some of the older traditional therapies, you know, are not as beneficial or as quick at helping people move through and to get to the other side.
Yeah, it's, well, it's like I said before, things change, so
mm-hmm.
things are different now.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you to speak up just a little bit, Lori, so that I could hear you a little better?
Yeah, I know that that's, it's something to do with our connection, which unfortunately is not as clear, as strong as sometimes they are.
Okay.
Yeah. Why don't we talk a little bit? Now, we talked about alcoholism. We've certainly talked about death. You know, you had a huge aspect of your life that obviously mirrors this book. What about the job?
Yes. In the first half of the book, you're talking about the first half of the book
of yeah.
school.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, for those people who haven't read the book, I worked, and it was almost exactly the way it's written in
wow.
the book. I worked at a school for emotionally disturbed children here in Los Angeles for 5 years, and I ended up being fired from that school after 5 years, and basically it was because they cited poor staff relations, and it was because the staff of the school, a lot of whom consisted of people that did not have degrees or credentials. You know, they were teachers'
mm-hmm.
aides, bus drivers. Some of them were high school graduates. Some of them weren't.
Wow.
And, you know, in my opinion, they were using corporal punishment. They were, you know, hitting the kids or intimidating the kids or not allowing them to have food, making them do excessive exercise. The school model was to use punishment as a way to teach the kids to behave differently rather than reinforcement for when they were doing things the appropriate way.
Right.
And, you know, coming from my background, I couldn't stand the punishment. It just totally went against my grain. And so being there for 5 years, when I first started, I tried diplomatically to have conversations with different staff members, and they became very resentful. You know, they just didn't want to hear what I had to say. And so we were at cross purposes, and things escalated over that course of 5 years. There were a lot of incidents that occurred where just in real time, I would try and fix them in real time. Like if I walked in on a situation where I saw a child being abused, by my definition, I would simply remove the child from that environment right then. I would just take the kid with me.
Right.
And because of, you know, the rank, in other words, I was the counselor, they were the teachers or the teacher's aides, they had to let the kid go if it was a teacher's aide. The teachers themselves did not have to let the child go. And what happened was after, you know, in my fifth year, all the teachers had always deferred to my wishes, but in the fifth year they had a new teacher that they hired, and she didn't want to defer to me. And so we ended up having several confrontations, and that's when they decided to fire me instead of firing the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't pretty.
Mm-mm. And as you mention in the book, you know, you made a lot of money for them, or at least they billed a lot of money for you.
Yeah, well, all of the counseling that the kids got, and, you know, I was culpable of signing off on hours that I knew were not accurate. I worked for 30 hours a week, and I had a schedule of counseling children for 30 hours a week. And when they first hired me and they explained what my schedule was to me, I said, well, this doesn't make sense because, you know, I have lunch, the kids go swimming, kids are absent, you know, their classes run over, they might go to see the nurse. It doesn't make sense that I would be able to see 30 children in 30 hours. And they explained to me, they told me that this was normal protocol and that there was nothing to be concerned about, that they would adjust the hours at the end to match what had actually occurred. And all they wanted me to do was sign an attendance sheet confirming that whatever they put in was the correct thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was the first time that I had worked for somebody else in about 15 years. And I was going through a very difficult time at home with Jimmy. His drinking was pretty much out of control, and I knew that we were facing foreclosure on our house if I didn't get a job, because our private practice had dwindled so much. And so I just thought, well, you know, I'm just going to do it, because I needed the job. And so I signed all those attendance sheets, and they weren't true. So all of that came out when I was fired. I tried to sue them for wrongful termination, and all of that came out, but still didn't help. I did finally contact the LA Times and reported the school, and they sent a reporter there and a photographer there, and it was a front-page story on the LA Times. What happened was they were forced to make a lot of changes in the school, but they didn't lose their license, and I didn't lose my license. I mean, they just, you know, it's like everyone sort of got instructions on what needed to be done to change, and they let us all keep our licenses.
Wow. So themes in your life, you know, of, I don't know, you know, how you see it, but as I looked at it, it looked like, you know, wherever you went, you just didn't seem to get the support. You know, between your family and, you know, your boyfriends and your job, there just seemed to be this underlying pain of besides the work you did with AA and connecting with a deeper spiritual part of you, what was that guidance that you got? Like, were you able to connect in a deeper way? Like, did you feel you had angels?
Well, the way that I look at it is I act as if I have angels. Some days I'm convinced that there really are angels, and I'm convinced that there really is, you know, a God out there who's able to pay attention to every human on the planet, or at least have his angels do so.
Mm-hmm.
That there's some kind of hierarchy in heaven, and, you know, everybody gets an assignment. And then other days, I think, well, that's ridiculous. There's, you know, there's no God, there's no angels, and you know, it's an accident that we're here, and I sort of go back and forth depending upon my own mood.
Right.
I would say that more often than not, I prefer to think that there is a God and that there are angels because it makes me feel better to think that.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the old story of, I believe in God, but I'm going to still lock my car. Or, you know, I believe in God, but I'm still going to tie up my horse. What I do is I act as if they're there, but I don't rely on them to make everything different.
Right.
Or to help me. I don't rely on it. The only thing that I rely on is that I know for sure that the universe is huge, gargantuan, way bigger than I could ever imagine, and that there is so much that I don't understand. I mean, you know, it's sort of like I don't know how a car works, but I know that it gets me to where I need to go. And so I know that I can rely on it to a certain extent, but it can also break down.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of figure that if there is a God, that he can only do so much, and if there are angels, they can only do so much, and that I still have to do the footwork. And basically all I can do is just get out of the results. You know, I mean, I can write the book to help myself, but what happens to that book after I send it out into the universe, I can't control that. I can have a website. I can have noelzark.com to try and bring people to me and to the book, but I can't make them come.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it helped me a lot to think that, yes, there were angels, and that when I wrote the book, in the moment that I was writing it, it was very helpful to me to act as if. I actually work with my patients to, I have a little phrase, I call it right here, right now, and the word right is spelled W-R-I-T, right here, right now, W-R-I-T, right now. And what I find is that if people just suspend their disbelief for a few minutes and they write something right now to people that have passed, and it almost doesn't matter whether it's a relative or someone you knew or even a total stranger. You know, there was a book many years ago called Think and Grow Rich.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the author's
name. Napoleon Hill.
I'm sorry?
Napoleon Hill.
There you go. I was going to say Napoleon, but I couldn't remember his last name. Napoleon Hill wrote a book where he definitely said to imagine conversations with people of great wealth and great intelligence and think about what they would say and use that as guidance on how to proceed. And that's pretty much the way I do it with my angels, and that I encourage other people to do the same. I imagine what angels would say to me, specific angels, whether it be my mother or my father or Jimmy or Adam and Eve or John F. Kennedy or whoever it is, somebody who I would want to know, what would they think, what would they say? And I just take away that inner critic, I take away the judgment and write what I think they would say. And I just let it flow. And then when it's over with and I read it, I get real goosebumps because it just seems so right on the money. And I found when it's not just me, I mean, when I do this with other people, you know, they start to cry, they get goosebumps, they feel, it's a purging process. And anytime you purge in a healthy way, can't hurt, you know, it's only got to help.
Mm-hmm. You talk in the book about, you know, risk, and that it's exposing your true self. I guess, you know, to be authentic and to, you know, to be real, you know, we were taught as young children, how to, you know, hide behind what we feel, what we think, to, you know, to look pretty and, you know, to be seen and not heard. You know, we were taught really how to be inauthentic and never to expose our true self. And I think certainly in the last little while, last couple of years, that, you know, there's been a movement or part of us being able to be who we are. We have to really be our true self, and we have to be authentic and not, you know, sugarcoat how we're feeling, and not, you know, just because we're trying to fit in or we're trying to be, you know, approved, which is, you know, what you talked about in the beginning, how important it was, you know, to be loved, to be approved, and that really isn't what counts.
Yeah, I mean, to be a people pleaser is a very difficult way to live.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I know that my brothers are not bad people. I know that they are good people with good hearts. Their families love them. They have friends. I don't think that they intentionally tried to hurt me, and I don't think that I intentionally tried to hurt them or my parents. And sometimes when you do express your true self, how you feel about things, it hurts. People get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can use the psychological verbiage of people are, they're choosing to feel hurt. They're choosing to let their feelings be hurt. They're taking it personally rather than not. But it's a very difficult thing to really not take things personally. It was very hard for me to come to the realization that me getting disinherited and cut out of the will was, even though it was meant personally against me, that I couldn't take it personally. I couldn't accept it as a personal affront.
Mm-hmm.
I had to accept it as this was what they did. They did it for themselves and not against me, even though that was the way it was presented. That, you know, they are their own people, they have their own journey in this life, and they have to live with what they do just like I do.
Mm-hmm.
Did that address what you were...
Yeah, but it, I mean, I guess also, you know, to be true to yourself, I mean, this is this risk that you spoke of in the book, is that, you know, you have to be true. You have to be authentic. You can't pretend anymore. And I think that seems to be a big theme in the spiritual evolution. I mean, a lot of spiritual people out there, you know, say to you know, detach from everything, and, you know, some of our emotions, you know, aren't good. And so there's part of this movement is to be very inauthentic still. And, you know, like our ego doesn't have, you know, another purpose in protecting us, that it's, you know, it's evil, and so you must detach from it. And, you know, it's really not authentic to not, you know, learn to embrace some of the darker energies, some of the shadows that we experience.
Well, you know, I think I understand what you're saying. I would say that it's one thing to acknowledge the negative emotions or the negative feelings, but mm-hmm. it's a whole other thing on learning how to express them and express them appropriately.
Yes.
And that may be where the authenticity is a difficult tightrope to walk, if you will. I can feel angry at someone. It doesn't mean that I need to express that anger in the moment. And by not expressing it, it doesn't mean that I'm being inauthentic.
Right.
And you don't have to necessarily be a politician, but I guess what I'm going to say is that there are ways to say things where you're being authentic, but you're not being hurtful or negative.
Right.
And some of that has to do with what I was saying before of whether you yourself are in a victim place where you think you're being done to, rather than just recognizing that what the people are doing, they're doing for themselves, and that you don't have to take it personally. So it diminishes some of the anger, and it diminishes some of the negative emotions that you might feel when somebody says something that sets you off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can, your original, your initial reaction might be from the dark side. Your internal initial reaction can come from your own dark side. But if you take that deep breath and you count to 10 and you let the light shine through rather than the dark come through, then you can find a way to express yourself that's still authentic but doesn't draw from the darkness. Instead, it draws from the light.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And, I think, I always, whenever I want to talk about this, it's about, being that child. When you're a child, you can have your little temper tantrum, or you can have, it's never personal. It's never attached to somebody else. It's really your own, you're in your own little world, and you experience what you experience, and you don't, 5 minutes later, as long as you're being authentic and you're, you can acknowledge it and you're not trying to win somebody's approval, you work through it very quickly. Where we tend to hold on to things and, belabor them and, take a grudge and, we aren't being authentic. But I really appreciate what you're saying, and I really appreciate how, you dealt with a lot of things, because you've dealt with a lot of things in your life. And so, to be able to get to that place of forgiveness. And do you want to talk about forgiveness? Because that's a huge, that must have been a huge hurdle.
It was and is. certainly there are days when I wake up and I'm feeling very resentful and very angry, and I have to remind myself, oh yeah, I don't have to do that anymore. I've done a lot of reading, a lot of books. I've read a lot of books about forgiveness and meditation and spirituality and on becoming whole and free of the bondage of self, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I like to read novels about ordinary people becoming extraordinary heroes in their own lives. Mm-hmm. And I use those characters as role models because I don't always find a lot of human role models. And one of the books that I read actually had 9 steps on forgiveness, where you have to know exactly how you feel about what happened and be able to articulate where you can tell a trusted couple of people about your experience, and then make a commitment to yourself to do what you have to do to feel better, because the forgiveness is for you. It's not for anybody else. It's me internally that has to do the forgiveness. And it doesn't matter whether, like, for example, in the case of my brothers, I'm sure that in their minds, they have their own perception of what's occurred, and they don't think they need to be forgiven of anything.
Right.
They think that they acted in a true and correct way. And if anything, they think that I'm the one that needs to be forgiven. For whatever aberrant behavior they thought that I did. So I can't get inside their head. The only thing I can do inside my head is forgive the injustice that I think I experienced. I have to forgive that. And that's part of that is, it doesn't necessarily mean reconciliation, although in my case I was able to accomplish that, I think, to a certain degree. And I don't have to condone their behavior. All I have to do is find peace with it,
mm-hmm.
and acceptance. It is what it is. It's sort of like having a reality check, gaining a right perspective on what's happening. That my primary distress is coming from my hurt feelings, not what actually offended me or hurt me.
Right.
Or what I thought hurt me. It's just the way I'm perceiving it. And it doesn't matter whether it happened 10 years ago or whether it happened 10 minutes ago. If I can forgive the situation, it helps to heal those hurt feelings. And, you know, I mean, you can do that with simple stress management techniques of breathing deeply and, you know, closing your eyes and letting go. And then, you know, the other thing is that part of it is that I kind of gave up expecting things from other people that I used to expect. And that I used to think I, like what I said before about people owing things.
Right.
I used to think that that people owed certain things to each other, and that you could expect certain things from people. And then when I didn't get them, that's when I would be upset. And, you know, really, instead of expecting things, the only thing I can do is hope for things. You know, I can hope for health and love and peace and prosperity, and but I can't expect them, you know. And so I have to put energy into looking for another way to get my positive goals met rather than looking for some sort of change in the experience that hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there's always that expression, that a life well lived is your best revenge. So instead of focusing on the wounded feelings and giving the person who caused that pain power, instead you learn to look for the love and the beauty and the kindness that exist around you, and you have gratitude for those things. And the forgiveness is more about reclaiming a personal power rather than letting what you think hurt you have the power.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you talk about a risk, you know, there's probably a risk in doing that, but I think that as long as you remember what occurred, it's kind of like there's a story about a scorpion. And how a scorpion will always be a scorpion. So even if it tells you that it's not going to sting you, it's still a scorpion. So you have to remember who you're dealing with, and you have to remember what people are capable of. And yes, you judge them on past behavior, but you also have to recognize that people change. So, I mean, for example, my brothers, if they were judging me on my past behavior, then they wouldn't be giving me the benefit of the doubt to recognize that I've grown a lot, and vice versa with them. If for me to recognize that they've had their own life experiences over these last 30 years and that, you know, and that they've changed and they've grown. And so for me to have a relationship with them now is possibly risky in terms of my feelings. But on the other hand, I hurt a lot more and was isolating a lot more when I didn't have a relationship with them at all.
Right.
The 7 years that I was estranged from them, I was miserable. And as long as I remember who they are and what their philosophy of life is, and I don't expect things from them that they can't give me, and vice versa, with them not expecting things from me that I can't give them, then it's less risky that our feelings are going to get hurt when we interact with each other.
Yeah. The last bit that I wanted to talk about was freedom. And, you know, part of what you say about freedom is, you know, don't waste the life you have, seize the moment. And you sort of started talking about that, and I think that's that comes in with, you know, the gratitude and, you know, really enjoying the life that you have, or finding a way to enjoy it. And I think there are a lot of people out there that, you know, need to read this book so that they can, you know, find that hope, and that they can, you know, work through some of the pain that the past has brought them, and to get out of that victim mentality and to find, you know, the same freedom that, yes, there are days, and there are always going to be days that we fall back on old patterns, and, you know, we do feel that pain, or we can get stuck in it. But I guess becomes, you know, how short is the times we get stuck in it, and how much can we, you know, experience the gratitude of the life we have?
Yeah, it's very important. In AA, they talk about making gratitude lists almost on a daily basis. If, you know, I mean, I have a lot to be grateful for right now. I live on a houseboat in Marina Del Rey. I've been here for 11 years now. I've been dating someone for the last 3.5 years who's clean and sober, very sweet and funny man. I have a new dog. Her name is Kelly, and she actually smiles. And she's a, I'm in the process of having her become a service dog so that we can go around to hospitals and nursing homes.
Nice.
So she can bring that smile with her. And people love to pet her and tickle her stomach and stuff like that. And, you know, I enrolled in a doctoral program this summer. I'm going to be able to call myself Dr. Levy. I'll have a doctorate in marriage and family therapy. And I feel very grateful that I was able to get into the program and have the opportunity to pursue that after all these years. I'm going to take a stand-up comedy class this summer so I can have some fun with all this angst. And, you know, it's just sort of like life is too short to let the anger and resentment mess it up.
Mm-hmm.
And having gratitude seems to be one of the simplest ways to take yourself out of that negative place where you concentrate on the positive rather than all the bad things that have happened.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would say, for people to, you know, go call their family members and tell them you love them and bring some joy to the moment rather than concentrating on the fight that you had, you know, on July 4th.
Right.
It just seems life's too short. You never know what's going to happen. You never know when people are going to be taken away from you, and you won't have the opportunity to say that. It's just really, really short, and you just don't know when people are going to be taken.
Mm-hmm.
I can't emphasize that enough.
Yeah. Well, Audrey, it's been, you know, a great pleasure. As I said, I really enjoyed the book. I think it gives hope. I think it, you know, I think a lot of people will resonate with your story, whether they've had similar things happen to them or just because we all have a story that that we hold on to, or, you know, hopefully we can learn to transcend. But we all have this story that where we feel we're victimized, that we feel we're alone, that we're, you know, that we're doing the fight. And, you know, this is a story that, you know, in the end, you know, you change some of the story to allow you to heal in a different way. And I know a lot of past life, you know, regression therapy does a similar type process where, you know, you learn to, you know, change the past so that you can move forward into the future. And I just think, you know, with all that you went through, and it's a great story to assist people, and whether they know that it's actually, you know, almost verbatim truth or whether they see it as a story to assist them, I think it's a very beneficial story because, you know, you can see, you know, the progression of your life and how you got to where you are, and that hope and that gratitude and that, you know, that joy of wanting to live is very prevalent in it. And I think, you know, one of the biggest things is that we need to learn to get the support. And so joining AA, you know, whether you're an alcoholic or not, the 12-step program gives you a support system that can assist many people to find that inner strength. And I think, you know, it's a lovely story to assist people.
Well, thank you. I think you're correct that a support group is of primary importance. And, because we're almost out of time, I'll repeat that I do have a website, noellezark.com, and people can buy the book there. It's only $13.95. It's also available at Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com, and you can order it from any bookstore, Noelle's Ark. you know, I think that what I tried to do with the book was rewrite my own life script. That's why I call it a novel.
Right.
Because I rewrote my life script, and that's what I'm trying to teach people how to do. That you don't have to live out your life thinking that all these predetermined events have occurred and, you know, you're sentenced to a particular life. You can change things.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all different ways to help yourself do that.
Yeah. Yeah, and that message came out nice and clear. So I hope that people do read the book. I hope that through that, you know, they connect with you and, you know, there's a sharing and understanding that people can relate and connect. So thank you, Audrey. It was great connecting with you and hearing the story again.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you, Lori.
Thank you.